Working Cows Podcast, episode 147.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. Very excited for today as I've ventured into my own property and started to experiment with some grazing techniques and some things that I've been learning over the last couple of years. I've started to consider the quality of life aspect of how we approach grazing and some of those different things. And so I reached out to Dallas Mount and I said, if you were going to interview two people with a bit different style of grazing, one moving more frequently, one moving less frequently, who would you talk to? And he said, I would talk to Stuart Austin and John Coleman Locke. And John, of course, has been a guest before on the Working Cows podcast. Stuart has been a guy who I've wanted to talk to in the past and have just always, you know, it's always a struggle to coordinate time zones and those things when you're talking to somebody in Australia, but we got it done. We got three time zones represented here: Mountain Daylight Time, Central Daylight Time, and Australia Eastern Standard Time, I believe it is. And so we're all together here to talk to them about why they graze the way they do and give them an opportunity to interact back and forth and ask some questions and talk about how they approach grazing on their operations. So pretty neat opportunity here. Thanks to Dallas for suggesting these two individuals. And thank you, John. And thank you, Stuart, for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Clay, for having us on. It's an honor.
And we're going to do something quite a bit different than anything we've ever done here on the Working Cows podcast. We're going to give these two gentlemen a opportunity to present the way they graze and why they do it the way they do it, and then ask each other some questions about the advantages, disadvantages, challenges, and the benefits of the style of grazing that they are implementing on their places. So John and I talked ahead of this recording and decided that since Stuart had the cooler accent, we would let him go first. So Stuart Austin is going to start us off today talking about what they're doing there at Wilmot Cattle Company. And I guess both of you are welcome to start off by describing your operations a little bit and kind of what business it is that you are in.
Sure. Thanks, Clay. Like I said, it's I was pretty tough to be asked to be on the Working Cows podcast today. Very kind of you, and thanks to Dallas Mount for putting me forward. I hope I can do it justice. I manage Wilmot Cattle Company as a general manager of three ranches that we have in the northeast of New South Wales in eastern Australia. So we're about halfway up the east coast, and this property is about an hour inland. So this property is called Wilmot. It's about 4,500 acres. We're at about 4,000 feet elevation and about 50 inch rainfall. So it's very high rainfall, very fertile. It's a volcanic basalt plateau here. There's about 40,000 acres on the plateau, and we're fortunate enough to own 4,500 acres of it. We have another property that is about an hour and a half southwest of here. It's 6,000 acres. About 30 inch rainfall and more of a granite soil. And then about 12 months ago, we acquired a third property 3 hours southwest of here on what we would call the northwest slopes and plains, on the top edge of the Liverpool Plain, which is also extremely fertile country, but a bit lower rainfall and lower elevation. So it's about 24 inch rainfall and about 4,000 acres down there with about 400 acres of centre pivot irrigation. So our business is primarily in trading cattle, or what you guys would call stockers, I suppose. We buy and sell a lot of cattle using Bud Williams KLR trading principles, I suppose, is what they're called in Australia. And but our one property, Woodburn at Walker, that I spoke about, that's 6,000 acres. It is primarily a breeding operation, so we would ordinarily run around 700 commercial cows there, and trying to breed an animal that is suitable for grass finishing. Our sort of long term vision for this business is that we would be a leading grass fed beef producer in Australia, being bred on our property down there and grown and finished on Morocco or Wilmot. That's probably sort of an overview, I suppose. I'll try to talk. I'll probably just stick to kilos and hectares. So there's 2.2.
Both of them are about 2.5, 5.
Yeah. That's right. 2.2 pounds in a kilogram, 2.5 acres in a hectare. When we talk about density, we talk about head per hectare. Probably don't often convert that to pounds per acre, but every now and then I will, just to sort of understand where we're at compared to some of the guys that we see and hear and read about from the US. So I'm not sure, Clay, whether you'd like to start talking about sort of density just yet, or whether John would like to go ahead and introduce himself.
John can introduce himself when it's his turn. So I think we'll go ahead and talk about density and about kind of what the schedule of moves is there at Wilmot.
Yep. So about 5 years ago, this property, I'll just talk about mostly about Wilmot today in terms of this property. We have a manager on each ranch, on each property, and they're all managed very similarly, but slightly different. But on Wilmot, about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, there was a real shift in management here. It had traditionally been a very set stocked, heavy steer growing operation, and severely degraded. And just to give you one factor that we've, or metric, I suppose, that we've been measuring since 2012, our soil organic carbon levels in 2012 on this place was around 2.3%. In 2013-14, there was a manager came here who he started the rotational grazing here, I suppose. He started combining mobs, moving more frequently, allowing more longer rest periods. And then in 2016, my wife Trish and I came here as the managers, and we continued that program and perhaps intensified it a bit more. So at that point, we were running around 2,000 head in a mob, and our kind of average paddock size, I suppose, was somewhere between 25 and 30 hectares, which works out, you know, when we were going through some of our smaller paddocks that were 20 to 25 hectares, we were operating at about 50 to 60, sometimes up to 80 head per hectare. So not massive density compared to what some of you guys are doing over there, but certainly fairly high density for Australia. We're extremely fortunate here in that there's natural watercourses that run through the farm that are that never stop flowing. So they provide a great water source, and basically now every paddock on the farm either has a flowing creek through it or a permanent trough. And when I got here, we started subdividing paddocks with a single hot wire, a single permanent hot wire. And we kind of got to a level, I suppose, that we were comfortable that we were seeing really good ecological improvement. And to go back to that soil organic carbon metric in 2017, so 5 years after we took our first soil test, and this is across 9 sites on the farm, on the same 9 sites, I suppose, every year that we sample. By 2017, our soil organic carbon levels were at 5%. So we've gone from 2.3 to 5% in 5 years, and we're still sitting right around that. In the last 2 years, we've measured bang on 4.7% average across those 9 sites for the last 2 years. And last year, in the last 12 months, we've been through an extremely dry period, the driest ever, you know, that's ever been at Wilmot, and half the farm was actually burnt in September last year. So we're quite pleased to have been able to maintain that soil organic carbon level at that level. So, but one of the things that we've learnt, and we've learned a lot of things here. We are firm believers in that you can't manage what you don't measure. So we measure everything we do here. There's sort of a number of parameters, but fundamentally rainfall, soil, grass production, kilograms of beef produced, and dollars, and the market. So we kind of keep an annual scorecard on all those things, and at the end of every financial year, which ends at the 30th of June, so we'll do an analysis of all the different parameters of the business, and from that look at our strengths and weaknesses and draw some conclusions as to what we need to work on. So two things that really stuck out in that first 12 months were animal production wasn't as good as we thought it should be. We were probably averaging about half a kilo per head per day year round. And there's a fairly common belief that in this country, in this environment, that should be a kilo a head a day. So we started to question, were we operating at too high a density? And the other big thing, the real factor that has made a huge difference to this business has been animal psychology. We just learned that cattle, their minds had to be in the right place all the time for them to be, their production to be pumping along and enabling us to keep turning over cattle and making money. So in the last 12 months, I can tell you that for over about 1,700 head that we've sold off the farm in the last 12 months, the average of all those animals has been over a kilo a day, which is quite pleasing. We've sort of been working up to that over the last 3 years. We got to 0.7 and 0.8, and we've always had a goal of our year-round production being over a kilo a head a day, and that's where we just got to. And we're turning over about 3,000 to 4,000 head a year off this place. The last 12 months has been about half that because it's been so dry, and then the fire on top of that. But so psychology is something we've worked really hard on, and we just kept, I suppose, experimenting carefully with density. And the other lesson we've learned is that the class of animal that we use to continue to achieve good ecological improvement, which is one of our major focuses, and make a profit, the class of animals made a big difference. So we've started trading what we would call a store cow, so buying a cow that's just weaned a calf that is in poor body condition, getting it fat, and then sending it to the abattoir, sending it to the meatworks to be killed. The real benefit in that is that they have, you know, 4, 6, 8 teeth, and they can churn through some of that grass that gets quite rank and turn that into kilograms of beef, as opposed to a younger animal with milk teeth. We've tried to jam that down their throat and we just don't get any production. It's a dance. It's always a dance, and trying to find that balance between continued animal production and good ecological improvement. And we're reasonably comfortable with where we're at, but we'll never stop experimenting, trying things. And at the moment, we are trying to work on increasing that density so that we get better utilisation, a more even graze. And particularly at this time of year, we're just in or going into our non-growing season. So we kind of shift from production focus to landscaping mode. So we'll slow our rotation right down, increase the density, make them eat quite a bit more than what we ordinarily would, recognising that production may go down a bit, but we'll get all our country into a really good state, ready for spring, and then our production will take off, and we'll sort of shift back to a production-focused grazing. So that's probably, in a nutshell, that's about how we operate, what we do, and where we're at. I was in the States last year, in March last year, and I did a flying tour over about 2 weeks. I had 14 flights in 14 days and went from Texas to Montana. And I looked at a whole bunch of different property, you know, ranches over there, and saw some really high density grazing that, you know, I got pretty excited by. But one of the things I noticed on just about all those operations, they were high density grazing with cows, not with stock of cattle. So I'm still quite intrigued, and I want to come back and see and hear and learn a lot more. And I'm really interested to hear from John and John's perspective and why he does what he does and the way he does it.
Sure. And what average weight are those stockers coming in, and then and you and what are they when they leave, I guess?
So coming in between 250 and 300 kilograms, so I suppose that makes them 700 or 800 pounds. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of 8 to 12 months old, and leaving here over 400 kilos. So I suppose around 1200 pounds, 1,000 to 1,200 pounds as a to the feedlot. Or if they're being grass finished, they'll go through to about 600 kilograms to be killed as a grass fed animal. Most of which ends up in America as a grass-fed beef.
Interesting. Okay, so appreciate that. I think that's basically like accomplished what I hoped we would get out of that first session. We'll let John have his turn. Kind of some of the things that I took away from that was you're about 21,000 pounds to the acre, I think is the math that I did, to 2,800 pound animals on about 75 acres or 30 hectares would be about 21,000 pounds to the acre. Does that sound in the neighborhood of right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about the math that I've done too.
Okay. So, and how often are you moving that mob?
Through our growing season, we'll be basically on daily moves, and we shorten our rest period. Our rest period will come down to sort of between 30 and 40 days. Through our non-growing season, we stretch that rest period right out to sort of 90 days so that all our paddocks are only being grazed once through our non-growing season. But there may be half a dozen grazes through each paddock through our growing season.
Okay. And before I go into full interview mode and ask a follow-up question on that, I'm going to turn it over to John and let him go on his portion of the show.
Thank you, Clay. As Stuart said, I really appreciate you creating this format, and I think this is going to be pretty interesting. Hopefully your listeners will find it interesting, and I know that there's a lot that I can learn from this, and hopefully other people will find some stuff to learn as well. As far as me and our operation here at Hungerford, Texas, I'm managing partner of Lock Division of J.D. Hudgens. We are a registered Brahman seed stock operation, and we're part of a bigger seed stock operation. And I think that's, you know, fairly unique that we're doing what we're doing with registered cattle. I call it unique. Most people call it crazy, which seems to be kind of a common theme. And I guess I want to start out by just throwing a disclaimer out there. I tend to get myself in trouble sometimes. I want to tell you guys, you know, about what we do and how we do it. And I just want to say up front that I'm not an expert. I don't have the scientific background that guys like Stuart do. And I'm not advocating that anybody go to the extremes that we go to. And for me, it's all been a fun experiment, and it's working for me. And there's a lot of reasons why it's working for me. It doesn't always work, but I just want to put that out there up front. I think people hear me talk about densities and what densities I find work, and they feel like they need to go out and try to increase their density. And there's a lot of pitfalls that you can run into. So the biggest part, the reason why we do what we do is, just like so many people, I'm a product of my environment. And we live in a fairly crazy environment. We're on the Golden Gulf Coast of Texas. They call it the Coastal Bend area of Texas. We're about an hour from the coast. We can grow a lot of low quality forage very fast when it rains. And like Stuart said, we've been through an extremely dry 12-month period. So it doesn't always rain. And in this type of environment, sometimes you can go 3 weeks, you know, we call them flash droughts. And I think most Aussies laugh at us and say we don't know what a drought is. But you can go a month without rain here and it really starts to hurt. So with being able to grow forage quickly, we have a pretty low octane grass. And so my goal the last few years has been to try to put some energy in that grass. And I'm trying to do that through density. I've got to give Ian Mitchell Ennis a lot of credit for kind of putting me on a path to challenge some of my paradigms about grazing. And I always say he turned on a few light bulbs for me and got me to thinking about it a bit differently. And so I've sort of been following his advice and his methods and learned a lot from him the last few years. We move cattle quite frequently, and I keep saying we. I'm pretty much a one-man show right now. I use a little bit of intern labor from time to time, a little bit of part-time labor. But it's me, myself, and I most of the time. My dad's involved in the business, but he doesn't do much on the management side. So typically, we're running at 200,000 to 300,000 pounds of density. We're running a mob of about, right now, since we've been so dry, we're running about 200 cows and heifers in a mob. And so they would typically graze an acre or less. And they would move anywhere from, I'm going to say, six to, I think my record when we started to get dry last summer, I moved cows 18 times one day. And you can see why I say I'm not advocating for anybody else to do this, because not many people in their right mind would do it. But one of my favorite books of all times is Essentialism. And one of my favorite quotes, and I'll probably butcher this, but it's something along the lines of an essentialist takes the time they save from eliminating the non-essential and invests it into creating a system that they can operate almost effortlessly. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the way that I see the systems side of our business. I've tried really hard the last few years to create a system to where I can spend my time observing and I can spend my time thinking. So when I say that I've moved cows six times, that might be, you know, an hour's worth of work at the most. And I can spend the rest of my time working on the business or doing other Whitby things or just observing the cattle and thinking. So it's probably not quite as bad as I make it sound when I say, you know, doing all of these moves. And I agree 100% with what Stuart said about measurement. But and this is where I can tell you again that I'm not advocating for people to follow in our footsteps. But we sort of fly by the seat of our pants in some ways. But we do a lot of observation, and we probably do a look at grazing as more of an art than a science, and that's not necessarily good. But we live and die by our cattle performance. Now, that's pretty easy to say when you're running cows. Stockers don't really fit our environment. We are running cows, which might be cheating a little bit, but we're also running some big cows, some big registered cows. And we're constantly monitoring gut fill and manure and animal performance. And Ian told me a while back, he said, stop worrying about what the grass is supposed to look like and pay attention to the cattle. And I think that is something that can really get twisted and misconstrued if you don't understand what he's saying. Because what Stuart said is exactly right. It's all about balance. It's all about balancing the ecology with the animal performance. And that's what we do. But we found that for the most part, if we're managing within our means, that when the cattle are performing well, the grass is performing well also. So, and I think, I don't want to ramble on, I'm kind of getting all over the place here, but I think if there's one thing that I want to talk about in regards to management and density, is that most of the time when you hear people talk about density, they, you know, it's a tool, just like everything else we have in our toolbox as grazers. And it sounds like most people refer to it like it's a hammer. I watched a YouTube video about the truth of mob grazing. And when you listen to people's vocabulary, it's take it down, you know, crush it, smash it. And generally, if people want to go for higher densities, they feel like they have to start with more feed to begin with. And so, and even Stuart said it, and you're talking a little bit about rank feed and the cows being able to utilize it. So I think you're starting off when you're shooting for higher densities, a lot of people are starting off on their back feet, their back foot anyway, because if they want to have enough forage out there to be able to run a high density, but not have to move their cattle as often, they're going to have a lower quality forage to begin with. And then they're going to take it down and they're going to crush it. So what we do, I refer to as selective ultra high density grazing, and you know, three words, frequency of moves. And most people are not set up to be able to do that and understand that. I think it's possibly an unfair advantage, or it's just, you know, pure craziness that we've figured out how to do that and still have quality of life. And then the other thing is severity of graze. A lot of people, you know, if they're using higher densities, they're using, they are crushing grass and they're maybe not necessarily expecting the animal to eat the plant or the majority of the plant, but I think that's what's happening a lot of times. And so severity of graze to me is so proportional to required recovery period that when you're crushing that grass, it's taken so long for it to recover. I'm fascinated at the ecological improvement, but it makes me wonder exactly what's going on with the plant community and the, you know, the energy in the plants and so on and so forth. So we do not graze very severely. We shoot for grazing the top third, and that word balance comes back because when you get that mob balanced and they're moving frequently, they seem to balance out so well that they're automatically going to graze that most nutrient dense part of the plant. They don't have to read any books to figure out how to do that. You don't have to do anything tricky. It just kind of comes natural. I am not sure that you can achieve that balance without frequency of moves. And like I said earlier, I understand a lot of people can't do that, and that's fine. So people ask me about density a lot, and I tell them, look, your first consideration should be appropriate grazing. Are we starting off with this grass that's, you know, in the right phase to begin with? And are we going to graze it appropriately? And then with your quality of life and your management, how many times can you move those cattle? How often can you move them? And then figure out what the appropriate density is after that. And I think that's where, you know, I kind of get frustrated whenever I see density, because I don't see cattle perform very well in high density situations for the most part. I think the psychology argument is definitely something that's interesting. And I think that's a fact, but I wonder how much of that goes back to that balance, that if you're not getting a high frequency of moves, maybe those cattle are a little bit nutritionally stressed and not just stressed because of the area that they're in. We can graze it 750,000 pounds up to 1,000,000 pounds and move very frequently. Of course, I'm not dealing with trade cattle that I've just brought in and, you know, co-mingled or anything like that, or I'm not dealing with turnover. I'm dealing with a herd of cows and heifers that have been raised on the place, and also Brahman cattle. So that's probably a distinct advantage there. So that's enough of my rambling. That's kind of some of my philosophies, and I'd be interested to hear some of Stuart's reaction to that.
Yeah, let's go there. I kind of wanted to make this a format of giving each of you about 10 minutes to share what you have going on, and you've done a good job of staying in that time zone, and wanted to then give each of you about the same amount of time to ask each other some questions. So I think we'll start with Stuart asking John some questions, if that's all right, and let Stuart ask John some questions about what they've got going on there, and then we'll go back the other direction.
Thanks, Clay. And thanks, John. I could just sit here and listen to you all day. It's a great privilege to be able to just share knowledge at this level and in this format. I've really enjoyed that 10 minutes, actually. And I agree with, you know, everything you're saying. I think we're very much on a similar page. Your comment about language is spot on. We you know, so many times I hear people who are starting to play with density, they talk about crash grazing or, you know, smashing it down, and I kind of say, we've got to wind back the, you know, understand what we're trying to achieve here. And that certainly relates back to the comment about psychology and nutritional stress, because that's by and large where the psychological issues were coming from, was we were actually overgrazing, you know, making the wrong class of animal eat the wrong amount of feed, I suppose. In terms of our, where we use cows, so we're a summer rainfall dominant climate, and it starts raining here sort of September, October, and by November and December, you know, we go from needing 1,000 head to needing 4,000 head within the space of 6 weeks, and we can't have cattle in every paddock on every day. So there's invariably country that, you know, feed that ends up bloody 3 and 4 feet high. But we've learned not to let that worry us. We just say, okay, now we need some cows, so we'll start buying, you know, trade cows at that point, store cows, and we'll use them as a landscaping mob, and keep our trade cattle on feed that we've been able to keep in a better phase for production. And I guess one of the ways that I try to explain psychology is that when I know cattle are right, because people always ask me what right is, but when I know they're right is when I can drive through a paddock and the only cattle that move are the ones I'm going to run over. And we've been at a point where we haven't been able to drive through a paddock without 2,000 head following us to the gate thinking that they're moving. And they'll stand there for the next 2 or 3 hours, and that has a massive impact on production. What that was a reflection of was them starting to anticipate moves and asking them to eat more than they wanted to eat. So those were some of the lessons that we learned, was that we recognised that, we needed to get their heads in a better frame of mind, that every time they saw a vehicle didn't mean that it was time to move. I don't expect cattle to move unless we put pressure on them and ask them to move. So we can now, you know, we'll drive through a paddock on any of our places now, and cattle, you know, like I say, the only ones that move are the ones we're going to run over. The rest of them just, you know, they might look up or they don't even know we're there. But if we go in there and start working backwards and forwards and asking, you know, putting a little bit of pressure on here and there and asking cattle to lift up and move, then they say, okay, it's time to go, and then they'll start to come together as a mob and move. So, yeah, we're on a pretty similar page, really. I think it's an absolute credit to you, John, particularly in a registered seed stock business, that you're doing this, and it's a real example, because that's probably the biggest comment I get here is, that's fine for you guys because you trade cattle. We can't do that in a breeding operation. And particularly around matching our stocking rate to carrying capacity and destocking and restocking fairly frequently. I'm a big advocate through dry periods to just keep destocking, don't buy feed. There will always be cattle available to buy. And you know, when the season turned around here in February, the way our three properties recovered was absolutely extraordinary. And we took advantage of that, and we went from 300 head on three properties to about 3,500 in 6 weeks. And we were a month or 6 weeks ahead of everyone else. You know, I was buying cattle and I was the only one there buying cattle to put on grass, because no one else had grown grass yet. So that was a massive advantage, and you know, we'll capitalize on that financially. But it was a reward for all the tough destocking decisions. And I mean, our 700 cow commercial herd got down to the last 80 first calf heifers and 120 yearling heifers. So we basically sold that whole herd. But now, you know, we've gone back over, we got up to about 1600 head there, I think, through March. But we were buying cattle that we could see opportunity in turning over cows and calves. And it was a reward. You know, that was not an easy decision for our manager there, who's been there for nearly 10 years. And he's put that herd together and just had them where he wanted them. So every time he had to sell 100 cows, it was a pretty heartbreaking decision to make. But now he's reaping the rewards from making those decisions. And so I kind of use that as an example to others and say, yes, you can do what we do with a breeding operation. You just have to, the old Bud Williams saying, you just have to love your grass more than you love your cows.
So do you have any
I probably haven't given questions? You too many questions there, John.
No, that's good, because I was scared you were going to ask me a really hard one and I wouldn't be able to answer it.
Yeah, nothing really comes to mind just yet, Clay.
Okay.
So I'll ask you, Stuart, do you see your biggest obstacle being the mindset or in the mindset and extra work, or do you see it a definite performance decrease? Is it a bit of both or one or the other?
It is a bit of both. I would say certainly, John, it is a mindset. It's a little paradigm blockage there. And like I say, when I went to the States last year and saw a lot of you guys and what you guys are doing, I was very excited by it. And I came home with a lot of energy to do that but didn't want to go from 0 to 100 in overnight. But to Jimmy's credit, who manages all our grazing here, I sort of planted the seed and I said, you know, it's up to you to do this. I can't make you do it. These are the benefits I think I saw from it and that I think we can get from it. And so to his credit, he started using more temporary fence. And I guess we're using the non-growing season to experiment with it because we knew that's when we wanted to do our landscaping, or shift into landscaping mode, where we wanted to some of that feed we'd been leaving behind or grass that we'd been leaving behind that wasn't perhaps the best for animal production. Now is the time to eat that to enable fresh grass to come through in the spring. And so we're doing that again now. I mean, the boys are using a bit of temporary fence. So it is a bit of a blockage. And the other thing would be water infrastructure. And we've actually just been talking about that in the last few weeks about how we might put a bit more poly in the ground and in the right places such that we could continue to increase that density a bit more. I was reading an article last night, John, and talking about bat latches, and I think that's probably something we need to start to implement here.
So, and I'm guessing you're one mob on each of those properties, or do you have multiple?
As few mobs as possible. That's the way I describe it to, to anyone that comes here and wants to understand what we do, is that we run the least number of the small numbers of large mobs. Here presently there is 3 mobs. We generally can run steers and heifers together, but this year, and I'm not sure why, but we had a lot of issues with heifers cycling and steers chasing them. So we've had to kind of run a steer mob and heifer mob this year, which has been a bit frustrating. And again, it reduces the density that we want to operate at. And then we've used that cow mob as a tool and as a landscaping tool, basically. And there might have been 200 or 300 cows in that mob, and we will use quite a bit of temporary fence to make them graze the way we'd like them to and do the job we'd like them to do.
No, and I think this might be a good place to say it too. It's funny, being in the executive link and helping with the ranch and profit school and all that, some guys could look at me like I'm a hobby guy and, hey, I'm running a 25,000 acre place and you're telling me I should be moving my cows 6 times a day, you're over there with your nice little cookie cutter 6-acre paddocks. And, I completely understand that. And I understand that that's why I said I'm a product of my environment, because if I was in a different situation, I might look at it completely differently. But I think it's interesting how we all pat ourselves on the back for challenging paradigms and being the ones that are, grazing when everyone's set stock. And then we just jump right into a new paradigm. And it's to me, that's kind of fascinating in our, I guess, community, you might say. So I understand that there's a lot of challenges, steers and heifers and everything else. But for a lot of people, I tell them that's the easiest way to increase your density is put your mobs together. Run one mob.
That and this is very applicable to me right now in this conversation, but one of the things that I say often is that I want action, not excuses. And we're making excuses as to why we're not doing something but for the most part, we're constantly experimenting and we're trying to take action to see what we can do. And one of the things, I suppose, and I spoke about this a little while ago in another thing that I was doing, was understanding, like doing the maths on actually what you're doing. And until your observation skills and feed budgeting skills get to a level that you're confident and comfortable at, I think it's so critical that you understand exactly how much grass you want that mob to eat, and so what time period it's going to take in that amount of space for them to eat that amount of grass and not overgraze or undergraze. And like, you know, in 1 week, I think I had three different blokes ring me and say, you know, we've got 400 head on an acre, but they're eating, like, you know, they're smashing it, they're way overgrazing it, and we're only moving them once a day. And I sort of said, well, you've got to work out. I said, that is a massive graze. We would never graze that amount of feed in one graze. So you've got to do the math on, and the other thing was, the other example was a guy had split his place up into a lot of 1 and 2 hectare paddocks. And I said, when you go with 400 head from a 2 hectare paddock in a 1 hectare paddock, you're going from 200 head per hectare to 400 head per hectare. And that's a 200 head per hectare is very high density. 400 head per hectare is extremely high density. And so psychologically, those animals, that's a massive shift for them. And I sort of use the analogy of if you put 400 people in a room and then halve the size of the room, everyone gets very uncomfortable very quickly. And you've got to keep that in mind. So it's this, you know, anything is possible. And John, you're living proof of that. I mean, what you're doing there is fantastic, and it excites me, and it shows that it's possible. I mean, you know, you can do anything if you put your mind to it. I suppose what I've just been encouraging people who are starting to experiment and try all these things, and particularly over here where we're using a lot of information that's coming from the US, is just to do the numbers and understand, you know, the precision that you need to undertake. Because if you're, you know, if that means that moving every 2 hours and you're an hour late, that's a 50% overgraze on that paddock, which is going to affect the animal. It's going to affect the grass.
I think that's interesting, and I agree with you 100% on doing the sums. And like I said earlier, I'm a little bit more of a fly by the seat of my pants guy. And I tell you, the problem with that is you'll get yourself in trouble. And I do get myself in trouble from time to time, especially consideration of, you know, rainfall and drought. But the flip side of that is you have to keep it simple, and you can make it so cumbersome and so technical. You do need to do that to a certain extent to hone your observation skills and make sure what you're seeing is matching. Try to do it in a simple way to where it's not like you just say, forget about it, you know, and you spend all your time doing that versus observing what's going on with the landscape and with the cattle.
Yeah. And I think one of the guys we just had out here, Jim Gerrish, that you guys would all know very well. I really like the way he articulates that and breaks that down into a really simple formula for people to understand. And he talks a lot about managing time and space. It's not about how many paddocks or how big the paddocks are or how many cattle. It's about the amount of time that you can spend with that mob of cattle in that amount of space, and understand and putting a number around that. And you're exactly right, John, about calibrating your eye every time. And I suppose that's why I talk about doing the maths, is that each time you graze, and I sort of encourage people to start grazing, increasing the density, increasing the frequency of move, start doing it. But each time you move, do the maths and work out, you know, and we're talking stock days per hectare, which I think is fairly similar to the ranching for profit animal days per acre. And so that might be 64 stock days per hectare, and the next graze might be 82 stock days per hectare, and the 64 might be not quite enough, and the 82 is about where you want to be. So the 120 is, it might be too much, but then that paddock might have had more in it to graze. So actually that 120 out of there was about right. But just putting a number around it so that you can start to say, you know, ahead of time and start feed budgeting and forecasting. And that's probably the single most important skill that I think any of our guys have learned, is how to feed budget and how to look ahead of them and say, okay, we want to go 60 out of there, 80 out of there, 70 out of there, you know, and then we start graze planning, you know, a month or 6 weeks in advance so we can see our whole rest period, you know, is that getting longer or shorter? Are we understocked or overstocked? And then forecasting right out 6 and 12 months in advance. And to give a little plug here, that's where we use Myer Grazing as our tool to do that. We can put those numbers into something that then spits out or gives us a plan that we're constantly monitoring and replanning, but it allows us to understand that is our rest period where we would like it to be relative to our grass growth and relative to the time of year. And so are we understocked or overstocked? So is there opportunity to buy more cattle or do we need to consider peeling the lead out and selling them?
One thing that's always fascinated me about that, Stuart, is how much easier that becomes on multiple daily move situation. Back when I used to graze and move once every 3 days and then once a day and then twice a day, it was so much more frustrating to be in tune. And maybe it's just time and experience. But if you look at cattle that came out of a paddock that were in there for an hour, it's so much easier to see what happened versus you come back tomorrow and you look. That might sound silly, but yep. It's always kind of fascinated me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think actually Jim said that last year when we were at the Grassfed Exchange, he said that doing that calculation 30 times, you will be 95 or 98% accurate. And it's something to do with the law of repetition that your eye can become that calibrated and that finely tuned. And so the quicker that feedback loop is, and like you say, John, you know, you'll do that. If you're moving 10 times a day, you'll do that 30 times repetition in 3 days versus, you know, if you're moving once a day, it takes you 30 days to do that 30 times repetition. So the feedback loop is extremely powerful.
Very good. I appreciate you guys going on there. It was really good. I do want to ask each of you a question kind of that came to my mind as you were both sharing. I'll start with John. How are you moving water? Are you grazing, setting up water one day and grazing away from that? 6 times a day or whatever, moving with a bat latch and they go to a new place and then walk back to water. How are you handling that?
Yeah, we have pretty much one water point will serve 4 paddocks. And so we have portable troughs. I can water at least up to 300 cows out of about an 80 gallon water. It's a plastic trough that just pick up on the buggy and move to the next spot. And we try to stage a few of them. Like sometimes we'll use 2 or 3 troughs, sometimes we'll use 5, but we don't back fence. We'll set our and they're not actually bat latches. They're a homebrew creation that I always tell people I could have bought 100 bat latches if I had taken the time that I spent on these silly things to develop them and put a dollar figure to it. So we'll set up on the water most of the time and then graze away from it with no back fence throughout the day. But there are exceptions to that because sometimes it's nice to start them not on water and allow them to graze towards water throughout the day.
Okay. Appreciate that. And then is the majority of your pipe run over the ground?
It's underground. And we could probably put pipe at 6 inches and it wouldn't freeze, but most of our pipe's 24 inches underground, 1.5 inches. And that, I don't know if it's because of our humidity or the distance traveled to water, but we can water 300 cows on 8 gallons a minute with only 80 gallons in the trough, which most people were blown away at that. And that's, you know, on a 105 degree day with 95% humidity. So we get away with a lot.
Over time, they just learn that we got to take turns drinking, right?
they do. And it's funny because we'll have water mishaps from time to time, and back in the day they wouldn't act right for, you know, 2 days, 3 days afterwards. They'd, you know, just be restless and drink more than they needed to and fight over water. And now they even handle, we had the well go out the other night, electricity went down and we didn't get water till 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they just stood in line and waited, and over the next several hours they caught up and completely balanced and, you know, never seemed to miss a beat. So
good. And Stuart, one of the questions I had while you were sharing is kind of what is your target stubble height for that fall graze when you switch into into landscape mode, as you said. How far down are you taking the grass? What are you leaving behind? Kind of how do you think about those things?
Really good question, Clay. We, unlike most of our neighbors, we look for as much species diversity in our pastures, and we did a survey here 2 or 3 years ago, and we had 74 different species of grasses, herbs, forbs, legumes, etc., and across the property here. And I suspect we've just done another one, and I suspect it's going to be somewhere around 100. After the fire and the dry, we've seen an enormous number of species come into the sward here that we haven't seen before. So that means that managing that height isn't a set rule, I suppose, on our more deep-rooted perennial summer species like our coxfoot, fescues, prairie grass, phalaris. Those sort of species, I would say probably 6 or 8 inches, maybe a little more. But on some of our more softer, shorter growing grasses like rye grasses and clovers and so forth, obviously that's quite a bit shorter. And it's where the density and kind of not giving them the opportunity to select quite so much where they would at a lower density means that they have to take a bite of everything, and that's how through our non-growing season, when we go into landscaping mode, that's where we're able to get all those species down into a more productive phase to what we would say the bottom of phase two, maybe the top of phase one, still leaving enough solar panel there or growth as soon as the sun starts to come out and when we start to get some moisture in September.
What I want to do from here on out is ask both of you some questions and have you give a couple of a sentence answer each, and that'll be kind of how we wrap up. So I guess the first one I want to pose to both of you, we'll start with John. What are some of the essential tools that you have in your tool bag to help you graze the way you do and manage the way you do?
To sound cliche, the first tool you need is an open mind. just think. And I have found that I've had people work for me and they go on to other jobs and they say, and basically resourcefulness is the way that I say it. And I've learned how to think through problems and do with less and figure stuff out. And I think that's the most important thing. I don't know where I'd be without a roll of polywire and some step-in post. I can set up 400 feet of polywire and take it down 3 minutes each way. So I could not even begin to accomplish the densities that we run at without some kind of timer control gate or fence razor. So that would probably be at the top of the list, roll of polywire and some timers.
Good. And Stuart?
I really like that first one, John. I would add, from our perspective, like I sort of mentioned earlier, probably the single greatest skill that any of our guys have learned is the ability to feed budget and put a number around how much feed they'd like to graze or grass they'd like to graze out of each paddock. And the other tool that we, make huge decisions with is Myer Grazing as a software platform that put some plans and some structure and some forecasts around the feed budgeting numbers, and it all our guys use it, so they're all on the same page as to what needs to move when and where and so forth.
Very good. And I guess another one that I had for both of you was and John, you kind of touched on it there, paddock design for time savings. Have you guys put a dollar per hour? What am I getting paid per hour to move these cattle? Figure to it. Is it worth thinking about in those terms? What are some of the things you're doing to save time with daily moves, with moving more often or moving less frequently? I guess John, you can go ahead first.
That's a great question. I can't really say that I've put a dollar figure on it. I just think it all comes down to one thing, and that's systems. I mean, we've created systems where You've got a checklist for starting out the day. You've got a checklist for heading out to the paddock. You've got a checklist for ending the day. We do certain things certain days of the week. And if you can create a system to where things become habit, if I'm going to move 5 reels and I'm going to do it in 20 minutes, you have to have some consistency in a system for how you do that to make it efficient to where you can spend the majority of your time on the important things, which are the thinking and the observing. So I would just say, you know, think through things and create some systems that work for you, and don't be scared to make adjustments.
Very good. Stuart, what do you think about that?
I would, again, probably haven't put a dollar figure around the value of moving cattle, but I do often talk about how much time we spend doing the $30 an hour jobs versus the $100 an hour jobs. And I mean, to hear John talking about, you know, being able to move 10 times a day and only an hour, spending an hour doing it, is tremendous and a real testament to the fact that it can be done. People think we're crazy. Just like you said earlier on, John, in your intro, I get the crazy comment all the time, and it intrigues me and entertains me. But it's the same thing. I mean, people say we don't want to move our cow, you know, we don't want to be moving cattle every day. And how can that be less work if you're moving them every day? And you know, I remind them we've only got 3 mobs of cattle on 4,500 acres. So our guys might only spend 2 hours a day moving cattle, and the rest of the day they're doing more productive things. Where, you know, if this property was set stock, there'd be 10 or 15 or 20 mobs of cattle. That's 10 or 15 mobs, troughs that we've got to keep an eye on, paddocks, fences that we've got to be checking, et cetera, et cetera. So it's getting, that's a real paradigm shift for people moving into this system of grazing, is that it's actually less work, not more.
I think Mike Livingston said it best. It's not more work, it's just different work.
Yeah.
And that's a good transition from both of you into the last one that I had, and that is, how do you think about quality of life and the style of grazing that you've chosen? What is going into, or how much of a consideration, I guess, is quality of life and the style of grazing that you've chosen?
I would wholeheartedly agree with you there, Clay. I think it's important that people do what works for them and do what suits them. But what I've really enjoyed this morning listening to John is that anything's possible, and you can still have that same lifestyle and move cattle 10 times a day. And that all that is a knowledge barrier. And mostly for us in Australia, I mean I would say that we're somewhere towards the front end of the line in terms of people who are pushing the envelope a bit with density and frequency of moves. And so, I mean, having someone like John come over and say and talk about what you do would give people some understanding that again, it's less work, not more. And quality of life, I would say, actually gets better, not worse. You know, I say to our guys, if we can't get done what we need to get done between 7 a.m. and 5 p.m., then we're doing something wrong. We're not an efficient manager, and there's room for improvement.
What do you think about quality of life, John?
I think Stuart said it there in the beginning. You know, that's my advice to everyone. Do what works for you. You know, quality of life is everything, and that's probably one of the biggest things I heard the first time I went to Ian's workshop. Was if you're not having fun, if you're not enjoying this, if your kids don't like to be around it, what are you doing it for? And so I put quality of life absolutely at the top. And there's times where I'm by myself, don't have any help, and you know, I'm putting too much on myself and I'm not having fun, and I change. The biggest part, I think the biggest reason why I do what I do, and I've gone to the extreme that I've gone, is because that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. That's what gets me going. I'm pretty sure that if it was standard that everybody moved your cows 6 times a day, I'd be trying to figure out how to do it once a week. And so that goes back to quality of life. You know, figure out what trips your trigger and do it within reason. Obviously, you've got to be profitable and you've got to make it work. But, and I'm not saying I'm going to do this forever. You know, we all change, we grow, we have different goals. Who knows? Maybe I'm moving cows 20 times a day 2 years from now, or maybe I'm doing it once. But if you're in agriculture, you have to figure out how to have a high quality of life. And so I put that at the top of the list, and I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't feel like it was adding to my quality of life. And if I felt like it was taken away from it, I sure wouldn't be doing it.
Probably just something, if I could just jump in there quickly, Clay, and add is that stress levels. Because we've only ever got cattle in one or two or three paddocks at a time, we can see 6 weeks ahead of ourselves in terms of our grass position, or at this time of year, 3 months ahead of ourselves in terms of our grass position. And when you're in a set stock business, and I saw it right through the drought, is the mental state of our friends and neighbours who were in a set stock operation. They were running out of grass that much quicker because they just couldn't see how much feed they had available in front of them, and how soon or when they needed to be making decisions. From our perspective, in terms of a stress level, it's so much less because we're always at least 6 weeks ahead of ourselves.
Very good. Well, guys, I really appreciate your time today. Love to give you an opportunity to share anything here at the end that you want to say, kind of wrap up or promote anything you've got coming up or anything like that. Go ahead and give that a whirl. We'll start with you, John, if you want to share or just say some final words.
Sure. Of course, because of COVID-19, we canceled the grazing workshop this year. Not 100% sure we'll have one next year, but it was a great time in 2019, and hopefully we'll do one in 2021, have Ian over here. So if people want to keep in touch and watch for that, that might be a great opportunity to fellowship and to learn some new stuff and challenge your paradigms. But my message is just like I've been saying, do what works for you, pay attention. Grazing, I'm fascinated with the parallels that you find between just living a good life and running a good grazing operation. And it's not something you're going to figure out. If you go into it with the mindset that I'm going to figure this grazing thing out and then everything will be good, it's not going to happen. You're managing chaos. You have to learn how to observe and get better at observing, and then learn what to do in response to what you're observing. So just keep an open mind and do something and figure out what works for you and do it. So I'll just leave you with that. Again, I really appreciate it, Clay, for having me on here. I appreciate you, Stuart. I've enjoyed listening to your management and stories from you. And it's been a lot of fun. I hope your readers or your listeners get a lot out of this, because I think it's a great way to have a little back and forth and a great way to learn.
What do you think, Stuart? What do you got to say here at the end?
Again, really quite similar messages to what John shared. And he said it earlier too, that density is just a tool. It's one of many tools in our toolbox. Can lead to greater, more rapid ecological improvement and better animal performance and make more money. And in terms of, some three key messages, I suppose, learning to feed budget that I've spoken about a few times. Again, seeing what, reiterating John's message about doing what works for you. And probably the other message would be, to me, what I've observed is that cows are very forgiving in terms of their production is not necessarily tied to weight gain. So they're a really good class of animal to learn about density with and experiment with. That would be my key messages. My greatest passion in life is helping other people, and that's why I really enjoy doing things like this and sharing what we do in the hope that it helps someone else. And I love learning from other people. So I share a lot of that on our Facebook page, on our Wilmot Cattle Company Facebook page. It'll be terrific to have some of you guys engaging on there in those conversations and sharing some ideas, because, like I said earlier, a lot of it's been so exciting to see people in Australia, you know, this drought's broken, they've finally got some feed, they've been reading and hearing and listening about all these things, and they're experimenting and trying it, and a lot of that knowledge and information is coming from the US. So, you know, to, if we had some engagement from you guys on our, you know, and some of those Facebook discussions would be terrific. And if you really want to get away from your winter, in the dead of winter over there in February, every year we have an on-farm field day here in collaboration with Meyer Grazing, and we had nearly 400 people here this year. So get a posse together and bring a bunch of you guys over here. It'd be tremendous to have you over here, and I'd love to show you around and share some ideas and thoughts. So put that in the calendar.
Sounds like a great opportunity. Thank you guys again so much, and we'll put links to all that stuff in the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/147. workingcows.net/147 is the show notes page for today, so you should find those links there. John, Stuart, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you, Clay.
Thank you very much, Clay. Really enjoyed it.
So very good stuff there. Really looking forward to future opportunities to do things like that and with different practices. And so if you've got ideas of individuals who would be good representatives for different practices and different things that they're doing, whether it be economic analysis or managing people or whatever, if we want to talk about it and get a couple people talking and going back and forth, I'm open to suggestions. You can hit me up at workingcows.net/contact. All the ways to get a hold of me are there. Speaking of which, we're going to be playing some voicemails at episode 148. At the end of episode 148, I'll be playing some voicemails. So if you want to do that, you can go to workingcows.net/141 and check out that show notes page and check out that episode to answer the questions that I asked. And then you can call the number 605-549-5401 and you can leave your voicemail there, and we'll play some of those voicemails coming up next week on the Working Cows podcast. So for now, that's all the farther I'm going to go with a preview of next week's episode. But I really appreciate you guys being a part of the audience and reaching out and giving feedback and participating in the discussions that we try to facilitate here about how you can get more joy out of this lifestyle.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.